You're listening to a Castaway Media podcast. Find more great shows at castaway.media or find us on Facebook, facebook.com/castawaypodcasts.
You are very welcome to the new episode of Bookish, a podcast about books and reading and all things like that coming from Dublin in Ireland. My name is Bob Johnston, owner of the Gutter Bookshop in Temple Bar and Dalkey.
And I'm Shane Breslin of Blackbird Books in Navan, County Meath.
So thank you for joining us. Just to keep you updated, you can listen online or in fact subscribe to get Bookish into your ear every month as we record it. castaway.media/bookish is the web address. And you can also talk to us and follow us on Twitter at Bookish Podcast. So we have a schedule that we normally run through. We do indeed. So we'll start off with a few bits of news around the bookie world. Move on to our book club segment, which is this month, Dead Secret by Ava McCarthy, a new Irish crime thriller. We then invite in our special guest for the trilogy slot, where a special guest talks about three books that they love, have inspired them, or just basically they really want to talk about. Then our rediscovered classic, roundup of some of the new books that we're looking forward to this month, and then we'll finish off with a few events and our final wrap. So, Shane, news.
Yes, well, it feels like it's the start of March now, so it feels like the bear of the book world has woken up from its winter hibernation. There's lots of stuff happening.
Let's run with that analogy. Where does that go exactly?
I'm reading Julian Gough's Rabbit and Bear to the kids every single day at the moment, and they're loving it, and it's all the bear waking up from
winter. Feel more bear than rabbit, obviously.
I feel more bear than rabbit at the moment, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so there's those happening. January, February, quiet time, obviously, in the book world, and I think everybody has got through it. And yeah, there's loads happening. World Book Day comes at the start of March. The Booksellers Association Conference is this weekend as well, if you're listening to this as it is available. Mountains to Sea Festival in Dunleary next weekend. And just seems to be loads happening at the moment. World Book Day, Bob. This is the 19th year of World Book Day.
Yeah.
It's our first since Blackbird Books opened. What's your take on it?
Well, World Book Day is a promotion, you could say, or a scheme that's been running now, as you say, for the last 19 years. And the whole idea behind it is basically to encourage children to read and encourage children to visit bookshops. So the basic structure of the scheme is that every primary school child in Ireland and in the UK will receive a €1.50 gift voucher through their school, handed out by teachers, that they can then take into their local bookshop and pick up either one of the special €1.50 books that are specially produced for World Book Day, meaning effectively they get a free book, or they can put it towards getting another book that they like and just pay the extra money. But the whole idea is to get children to go into a bookshop, find a book and take it away with them, and just encourage them to, you know, to partake of that, to be involved with it. So it's a huge scheme, goes incredibly well. I work on the World Book Day committee. It's part of my job as
part of the many committees.
One of the many committees I sit on.
And there must be two of you.
Oh, I wish. So we did a big event a couple of weeks ago, or a week and a half ago, in Liberty Hall for 400 kids, five authors. Madness ensued, as you can imagine. But it's all just about celebrating books. So kids go to school dressed up as their favourite book characters. Authors go in and do readings in libraries and schools and all of that kind of stuff. So it's really just to get people talking about books and reading, which in my head can only be a good thing. So there's 10 special books that are produced every year for World Book Day, plus a special 11th one produced by O'Brien Press in Ireland. So this year it was Brian Gallagher's turn to do the special Irish edition, One Good Turn. So, as I say, pop down to your local bookshop, pick up one of the World Book Day books, enjoy it. It runs now until, you know, the books and the vouchers are valid now to the end of March. I think it's about the 27th of March.
Yeah.
So you've got a while yet that you can go in and use those vouchers.
Absolutely. You know, a great, fantastic initiative. Again, it's, as I mentioned, it's our first World Book Day since we opened our doors last year. One thing that struck me a little bit was that we had an awful lot of people who, when we told them about it, had never heard about it. So it's even though it's in its 19th year and it has a lot of cut through in lots of places, there's still a lot of people that don't know about it.
Yeah, I mean, I still get, you know, you find yourself that, you know, I've had the shop in Temple Bar now for 6 years and people will wander in the door and say, oh, are you new? How long have you been here? And you kind of feel a bit bad saying 6 years, but you know, but where have you been all this time? But the good thing is, as with World Book Day, as with everything, new people will always come to the party, new people will always discover it, and you know, you've got to love that, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Staying on that theme, I suppose, and children and books and children and free books, a couple of little initiatives to let people know about the either side of the Atlantic. In Ireland, Book Bag 2016, which is an initiative, a book gifting initiative initially set up by Niamh Sharkey, who was laureate in the Nogue a couple of years ago. Niamh, the creator of the Henry Huggle Monster series, and it's delivered in partnership with Brown Bag Films and Children's Books Ireland. And it's aimed at schools in areas of disadvantage who may not have the necessary resources to fund author or illustrator visits or books for a school library. So the Book Bag Project, it's aimed at disadvantaged areas or disadvantaged schools, getting books into the hands of children, getting authors speaking to children. And that's one that has been running in recent weeks, I think. And on the other side of the Atlantic, a new initiative that I've noticed over the last couple of weeks, Michelle Obama launched it recently. I wonder would the Trumps be doing that when they get to the White House, stuff like this.
I don't know what books are, but hey, we'll run with it.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, Open eBooks, it's called. It's a new US initiative aimed at opening the world of books to children in need. So it's lots of the biggest publishers in the US. Penguin Random House, Hachette, Macmillan, all the big players are taking part. And again, it's aimed at disadvantaged areas. So schools, libraries can sign up to this. And effectively, it allows free borrowing of an ebook to be read on a digital device by children and families in those areas,
which is good. I'm always, as a bookseller, you know, you think, get them young, get them reading young, and you've got them for life, you know. So I'm all for it and whatever. It is interesting because I have heard in the last, you know, couple of weeks there's been new surveys done. I think Book Trust in the UK did a survey finding that kids still much prefer to read their books printed now.
Completely,
maybe,
yes.
You know, and
yep.
Of course we were all thinking, you know, we're the old fuddy-duddy generation who likes print, and you know, the young ones still can't tear them away from their devices. But I think again it's showing that they value, you know, your phones and your tablets are for one job.
Yes.
But reading is a different job. So, you know, so it's interesting to see how that will develop, because I'm not sure I would want to be pushing kids onto e-books. I almost think it's a good thing for adults to have, although personally I would never step beyond a print book, but you know, I'm rolling with it. But but kids, you know, I am a bit funny, they spend a lot of time in front of screens already, so I don't know about that.
And yeah, I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest that the kids just take in books a lot. They engage with books a lot easier when they're in printed form. And as the father, I've a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old at home, and they would never use it. I have to say, if the tablet or the phone is left around, they pick it up and they run with it, and they know exactly where to find YouTube and all sorts of stuff. But when it comes to books, they don't use it for those. So the other thing about it is that if the disadvantaged areas, how much access might they have to? You need a tablet, which is even more expensive.
You can get
a
free ebook, but what are you going to read it on?
Exactly. Yeah. So, but anyway, in principle, you know, it certainly wouldn't have a problem with it. Anything that can get books to kids in whatever format cannot be a bad thing, I suppose. Moving on to the next news item, but staying with ebooks, I suppose. Report in the Guardian from a couple of weeks ago, or that it was in several news outlets, about ebook sales declining for the first time.
Yes, that's it. The ebook's done and dusted, never to be heard from again, I believe. That's the way it goes.
Don't dance in that grave. So the client across the big caveat with this, I suppose, is that this is taking into account figures from the big five publishers in the UK, which are Penguin Random House and Hachette and the rest, the other big ones.
Yes, exactly. We can't name them anymore.
The main five. And declined, ebook says declined 2.4% last year. Every one of the five reported a drop. But the devil is in the detail here, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. I mean, I suppose the big thing that you ask when you see these things is, well, if people are reading ebooks, maybe they're just not buying them from the big five. And that's it. As we've always heard with ebooks, is that people don't want to spend big money on them. And, you know, the big five publishers are desperately trying to come up with models that work. And I think they're in a stage at the minute where they're not willing to devalue their authors' work by pricing them incredibly cheaply, but people who want ebooks want really cheap ebooks, so they're simply reading other stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
It throws open the whole question around ebooks and how it works, because effectively, as far as I can tell, nobody's really making any money apart from, you know, a few bits and bobs here and there which get lauded. And I think that's where the trouble's coming from, is people aren't buying them from the big five.
Yeah, and so this is the important to point out. This is the first year that the big publishers have been able to set their own ebook prices on Amazon. And I think there's definitely evidence to suggest that if you pitch a book at a higher price, you're just going to sell much less, fewer number.
Yeah, I think we do have to clarify, they can't set a price, because that would be illegal. But what they can do is they sell that book to Amazon at a price with a discount, and then it's Amazon's choice as to how much, you know, how much they could sell it for. So basically, you know, they could sell it for 1p if they wanted, but they'd be losing $18 on every book that they sold. So there's models in place there that they fit into, but they can't effectively set the price, if you see what I mean. But
yeah,
they can charge, you know, they can charge Amazon per book whatever they feel it's worth. What Amazon choose to sell it for is always going to be their choice.
Although Amazon have that for a lot of the books in the big five, they have the underneath the price now. They have if the price has been determined by the publisher, they have this price has been set by the publisher price. So that's new since about last April or May.
I could be wrong, but my understanding is it's the same as putting an RRP on the back of a printed book. You know, it says £7.99 sterling. We can effectively sell that in the bookshop for whatever we want to sell it for. But obviously, if I sold it for, I keep switching between sterling and euros and everything, but if I sell that book for €5, which I could do legally, would lose €5 on every copy I sold or whatever, you know. So although the price is being set by the publisher, it's still Amazon's choice as to what they actually sell it as, is my understanding.
Yeah, I'm my understanding was slightly different, but okay. Who knows? Who's to say? Yeah,
Why would we know how these things work, being poor booksellers?
Amazon.
Yeah, exactly. How would we know?
Price elasticity. Price elasticity is an interesting thing. Like the Amazon said that you have two e-books, one at $14.99, one at $9.99, that the Amazon will declare that they have all this data in which to do, that you will sell books at a 74% higher rate at $9.99 than you will at $14.99, and that they argue that generates all sorts of extra royalties for everybody. Everybody wins. The customer's getting a cheaper price. But there's any amount of articles online and blogs. It is a lot more complex than that, and clearly it's very complex because we have no understanding.
Should we move on quickly? Should we move on to something else?
Absolutely. Yeah. That brings to an end our news roundup for this month, and we'll move swiftly on into our book club choice.
Indeed. So I was the man who picked the book club choice for this month. I picked Dead Secret by Ava McCarthy.
You did.
A crime thriller by an Irish author. How did you feel about it, Shane?
Well, this is the first time. How many episodes of Bookish? This is the seventh or eighth episode? Mm. Eight episodes of Bookish. I don't know if we've had a book club in every one of those because we had a couple of Christmas specials in. But I think this is the first one that we've very definitely disagreed on.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think so. But as you've said, as you said, you're not a big crime reader.
I'm not. No, and it is. I'm certainly not going to sit here and slate a book that I didn't enjoy. And I didn't enjoy it. It just wasn't for me. I'm not a big crime reader. That's the first thing I'll point out. I've read lots of crime, and I often, as I think of you in speaking to you about it earlier, it is something you go to that maybe when you're looking for something a bit lighter or something you read a bit quicker after maybe a heavy literary book. The last crime book I really enjoyed was Gone Girl, which
I didn't like.
Interesting. So I think maybe kind of on the literary side of crime, maybe. I did enjoy the writing there. I'm reading Tim Park's book about I can't remember the name of it. Why We Read, or it's a book about reading and about where I'm reading from. It's called, and there was a little bit that really jumped out of that was when he was talking about plot driven books, or that books where you read. The primary objective of reading is to find out what happens next.
Yeah.
That isn't why I read. And I don't really enjoy plot driven books. And this was, like, it's fair to say this was very much plot driven. I think it was clearly like there was nothing that jumped out that it was out that it wasn't up to scratch in its space. But it just wasn't for me, I suppose.
Yeah, you see, and as I say, I am a crime fan, and I must admit, when I do a number of book clubs, you know, and we don't tend to choose crime fiction for book clubs because, as you say, it's very plot driven, so there's not always a huge amount to talk about. I think I chose it for our bookish book club this month, mainly just to challenge you to read something different because we hadn't done a crime book, because I was feeling a bit naughty. What can I say?
Oh, I didn't know there was an ulterior motive.
There you are. But also because, I feel it's kind of quite interesting to look at different genres and Irish writers who are writing in different genres, because I think sometimes, you know, when we talk about Irish writing, we are actually talking about literary fiction. I think there's a whole depth of Irish writing out there. So Ava McCarthy, Aveen, I believe, is her real Irish name, but obviously nobody outside of Ireland could possibly cope with that, so they had to be called Ava McCarthy.
And it's fair to say there is a bustling Irish crime scene. You know, they like the Declan Burke, Declan Hughes, Arlene Hunt, Hannah French. It is going well here, you know. So
yeah, no, definitely. Now I know, you know, Ava's had a few books out before. She took a break before this one. I think it's been 3 or 4 years since her last book. She took a bit of a break, so I know she had to come back to this. And just a kind of quick summary for anybody who fancies it. So the book starts with a woman, Jodie, murdering her perfect husband, Ethan, and going to prison for the crime. The prison section, very Orange is the New Black to me. It was a very kind of interesting look inside a woman's prison and whatever. And you could see the author's enthusiasm for writing about that scene and about what happened. So that's very interesting. And then kind of all the twists start appearing. So I'd say we can't really talk about plot because crime novels are very much driven on plot twists and whatever. For me, these worked really well in this book. It is kind of driven by twists and those kind of twists and turns and discovering secrets and that kind of thing, which I enjoy. As I say, I read it within a couple of days. I had a flight somewhere and back, and, you know, between the airport stays, it kind of flew through it. The sign of a good crime novel for me is, you know, it's well written, it's pacey. The twists work and don't feel, you know, like stumbles. They work, which was my big issue with Gone Girl, by the way. And it's got a decent ending. So many crime novels have really just rushed bad endings, and this doesn't. This has a good ending. There is kind of a twist right at the very, very end of the book, which fell a little bit flat for me, it has to be said, and felt a bit unnecessary. But apart from that, do you know what? I enjoyed it, and actually, it's been a while since I read a crime novel, and I actually just enjoyed reading it. So
fantastic. That's our book club choice for this month. Before we wrap up in this section, we have to point out our next pick, and this month it's me, and it is Needlework by Deirdre Sullivan, brand new book from Little Island. It's Deirdre has published several books for children. This is her first book for in the YA set, I guess. I think I'm right in saying that. So
yeah, I think you could class her other Improper Order and Imperfect, etc. We always class them as young adult, but this, I think, is a step up again for what she's doing. I'm really looking forward to reading it. I have had it sitting on my towering pile at home and I haven't got to it. So this is my push to get to Deirdre.
Yeah, I've done what I do with so many books over the last few months. I read the first 50 pages and I really, really enjoyed that. So I'm looking forward to getting to finish it now. So that's our book for next month. And read along with us, please, and tweet us your thoughts. Needlework by Deirdre Sullivan. Welcome back to Bookish. This is the part of the show, Trilogy, where we welcome a special guest every month to talk about three books that they love, that influence them, or just books they want to talk about and get more people to read. This month, our special guest is Dave Rudden. He's the author of Knights of the Borrowed Dark, which will be hitting the shelves very, very soon. It's from Puffin and it's out on the shelves on from March the 10th in Ireland. And we'll have a bit of a giveaway to tell you about later on. But Dave, very welcome to Bookish.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. Dave, you have brought three books to us today. And I think it's fair to say they bear resemblance, or they bear a lot of commonality with each other. The first one you want to talk about is Nick Harkaway.
Yes, Nick Harkaway's The Gone Away World. It is my favourite book. I know you're supposed to have like five or six. Oh, I couldn't possibly choose, but no, my favourite book is The Gone Away World by Nick Harkaway. I've bought 11 copies of it for people for different birthdays and things like that, so I think I'm single-handedly putting his kids through college. But but yeah, I'm a huge, huge fan of it. It's I probably should have chosen a book that's easier to kind of explain. It's a big, giant, mad circus of a book. It's sort of a post-apocalyptic Mad Max style novel by way of kind of an Iraq war satire, but it's also a love story, and it's also a story about two brothers. And I say this with all love, it's like it's all over the place. Like the sentences are all 14 miles long, and it's got a cast of like literal thousands. It's got ninjas, it's got mimes. It's just, I don't know, I just love one of the reviews described it as spending a week with a hyperactive puppy, and that's exactly what it's like. Yeah.
As the owner of a hyperactive puppy, I'm not sure if that's a great thing. Our hyperactive puppy is now a 3-year-old hyperactive dog, and it's getting worse by the day. I was reading a few Goodreads reviews, because this isn't one that I've read. I haven't read any Nick Harkaway.
I'm one of those that I know it. Yeah. And I actually can't remember if I've read it, which suggests I haven't, because it's one of those books that sounds like you would remember if you'd read. But you know, one of those books you think you've read?
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
It's one of those for me. So,
But
I've always heard great things about it. So,
some of the Goodreads reviews I read, it's one guy said it was that Nick Harkaway was humanistic, cynical, one of those humanistic, cynical, insanely creative authors who truck in wild and woolly tales that blur the boundaries of reality and fantasy. It is not a genre novel and not a straight up sci-fi fantasy novel, and if you're expecting that, you might be disappointed. Is that kind of fair to say? Or
I suppose, like, I'm always kind of a little bit reluctant to pop things into genres, because I know when someone hears the word fantasy, some people do just switch off. Mm. And there are like fantastical elements. I suppose magical realism is the thing. It is very much this world, what all of the good things and bad things that implies. But there's a lot of fantastical elements. I know he describes it as existential pulp, because it is an adventure novel, but it has an awful lot to say regarding like current events and foreign policy and things like that. The thing, I suppose, that really categorizes it for me is that when you read it, you do think it is all over the place. There are so many different elements, but he really, really brings it. Like it really, really influenced me as a writer, because I don't want to spoil anything, but at the end, you're like, there was no randomness. There was no like madness there. It was all really, really controlled, but with the, it's sort of a controlled kind of madness, basically.
And any elements of Gone Away World or Nick Harkaway in general that find their way into Dave Rudden?
I suppose.
I thought he just said controlled chaos. That sounded about right.
It's my hair, baby. But I suppose it's the idea that, like, when you're sort of like, when I was writing my first novel, I was kind of like, oh, maybe I should like play it safe, and I don't want to, obviously I want to get an agent, I want to get a publisher, and I don't want to freak them out or scare them away. The Gone Away World is Nick Harkaway's first novel, and it takes so many chances, and it sort of kind of proved to me that like you can be adventurous, you can take chances, you can trust your reader to come along with you. You just have to make sure that it's good enough, basically. And he really, the quality of his work, kind of like, even if you're not into fantasy or into sci-fi, the book is so good anyway that anyone should read it.
Very good. The second book you have, and again, it's, so we're kind of going from Nick Harkaway to kind of one of the kind of one of the key influencers in this area, I guess. Yeah. And Neil Gaiman's Fragile Things. Why have you chosen this?
So I'm a huge Neil Gaiman fan. I've read everything that he's ever written, except fortunately The Milk, which is for very small children, so I haven't read it yet. But yeah, I've read everything that he's ever written, and I chose Fragile Things specifically because it's one of his short story collections. And aside from being really, really, really good, it's got, Fragile Things has like three of my favourite of his short stories in it. It has A Study in Emerald, which is his Sherlock Holmes, Cthulhu mashup. I know there's probably a more literary word to use than mashup, but mashup is the word that I'm using. Yeah. And that is, it's fantastic. And I think it won a Hugo, or might have won a Nebula, I'm not quite sure. It's got Feeders and Eaters, which is a horrifying short story. It's really upsetting. Kind of like Neil Gaiman's work when he goes for the horror side of things. It's sort of like coming home. It's like your house or your apartment, and everything's fine, everything's grand. And then you realise things have been moved. Like you realise like a door is open but it wouldn't have been closed, or someone's like moved a picture, and that slow crawling sense of horror that like things that were once familiar are now like really different. So Feeders and Eaters is like that. It's without giving too much away, it's the narrator is, he's missed his train and he's sitting in a cafe, like an all-night cafe, and he meets an old acquaintance, and the old acquaintance tells him how he's been since. And you know when someone you don't really know overshares something really, really horrible, and you kind of don't know how to feel, this is sort of what that story is about. And the other thing that I really love about Fragile Things is at the start of the book there's kind of a short paragraph on each of the short stories and where he got the ideas for them. And as sort of, it's when I was starting off as sort of a journeyman writer, that was so helpful, because you look at these things and obviously they've been edited 15 times and Neil Gaiman is an amazing writer and you're like, I can never do that, I'm never going to be that good. But then when you read one of his stories, it's called Faceless Brides in the House of Forever, I think it's called. It's a really long title. He explains that he wrote it when he was really, really young and he thought it was terrible and he left it in the box under his bed. And then he came back to it years and he's like, oh, it's actually not bad. And then he went back and he like edited a bit. So like for me, he was like, oh, you started off with ideas as well, and you started off not being good, and maybe someday I will be anywhere near as good as you, basically. So it was kind of inspirational.
And you started off with short stories as well.
Yeah, I think.
And a couple of award-winning short stories, I believe, Dave.
With Nick Harkaway, I emailed him once when I know people often email writers, and I started getting like a couple of emails about giving advice, and I think it's really important for writers to kind of give advice down the line. But I emailed Nick Harkaway I was at a house party and everyone else had fallen asleep. I was like 19 because this is what you do apparently at a house party when you're 19. You email a writer. And I asked him, did he have any advice for somebody starting off? And he got back to me and he gave me some really great advice. He told me to get into short stories and practice. And just that, again, that thing of like an established writer reaching a hand down to someone who was just starting off, I thought was really, really great.
And Gaiman himself, do you think that, like, I have the sense that Gaiman, while he is a key influence for people like writers like you, starting out, so many people cite Gaiman as one of their big influences.
Yeah.
I get the sense that kind of to the wider reading public, he's still maybe a little bit underappreciated. Is that wrong, or is that wider mark?
I don't know. Has he kind of jumped the boundaries of the genre? I know he's, yeah, because like a lot of people wouldn't have read his novel, but a lot of people have seen Coraline, and a lot of people would have seen Stardust, and he's kind of one of those writers when you explain it to them like that. I don't know. I know he's like huge among fantasy circles, but I don't know if has he had any like New York Times bestsellers or anything like that would have, like,
I'm sure he probably has. I just get the sense that he isn't
he's that bizarre mix of a very popular author who's also a cult author.
in a way, if you sort of made. So where does that
lie? I guess he's had
things adapted for BBC telly and radio and stuff's in there. So he is out there and, as you say, major movies and whatever.
I just get the sense if you post a picture up without a caption, and you ask 10 people who would they know who it was, and I think there's a good chance that probably a lot of people wouldn't.
Yeah.
And he's huge on Twitter, so we must include that on our next tweets.
Yes, at
Neil Gaiman. At Neil himself.
The angle for a retweet from Neil Gaiman. That's the way to do it. Thanks, Dave.
Multimedia. One of the things I noticed about Gaiman is that the days of the author as writer are kind of seem to be coming to an end. And he did a big multimedia show, I think, last year or the year before. And do you get the feeling that that's the way it has to be for authors and writers in the scattered world of media and multimedia?
I kind of think we are heading that way. I know as a children's writer, it's hugely important to get out into schools and into libraries. And it's something that I've always done because I used to be a teacher and used to be an actor. So I have a voice you can hear in Canada. And standing in front of 100 kids is fine. Although I have to resist the urge to shush them, which is not my job as a visiting writer. I was actually in a school once and the teacher introduced me and then he fell asleep.
Name and shame.
Yeah. Oh, God. But I do, and it's weird because writing and, I guess, performing aren't the same type of skill. Like, a lot of writers don't write to be read aloud. A lot of writers don't like being... And that's totally legit and totally fine. But I do think in terms of children's fiction, I think in terms of fantasy, people do love a show. And Neil Gaiman is very much in front of his own work. And he does shows with his wife, Amanda Palmer. And he does readings. And he's a fantastic... voice for readings. It sounds like someone pushing a wardrobe down the stairs. It's really deep and I have a cabin accent, so it doesn't really work. But I do think, you kind of have to be involved. You kind of have to be a brand as well.
Yeah. And we look forward to the Rudden brand going as time goes on. Moving on to your third choice, and somebody who Gaiman collaborated with, I think, very famously during his lifetime, and the late great Terry Pratchett. Out of all the Discworld novels, and there are lots of them, which one have you chosen and why?
I've chosen Mort, and it wasn't an easy choice because I Terry Pratchett is my guy. He's ever since I was a kid, that was the absolute pinnacle of writing for me. And I chose Mort, I guess, because if people are listening to this and haven't read Terry Pratchett, Mort is your book to start with. It's the fourth of the Discworld novels, and the first three are him sort of playing with the world and finding its shape, and then Mort is, I guess, the first really recognisable kind of Discworld style. It's also just lovely. It is a lovely, lovely book, and has pretty much my favourite Discworld character, which is Death. So,
who speaks in capitals throughout, which we love. I was going to say Mort is probably, I haven't read a Discworld novel in years and years, and I know they're kind of finishing up now. I think, I don't know if there's one more kind of hiding out there or if they've called a line on it. But I must have read, when I was growing up as well, in certainly my early teens, I loved the Discworld books. And they are fantastic. And I think, again, it's fantasy, so lots of people don't want to go near them. They think it's kind of funny fantasy, not really their thing. But they're actually great books.
They are. They're so, because they are very silly in places. He has a knack for being, one of my friends calls him, the silliest smart writer you're ever going to read. Because in his book Pyramids, for example, which is sort of a take on Egypt, the country is called, it's D-J-E-L-I-B-E-Y-B-E, which is named after the literal translation is Child of the Jell River. And it's only years later I realised, it's Jelly Baby. The country's called Jelly. It's so stupid. And then he'll mix that in with some of the most clever kind of takes on religion, on war, on racism. These really, really amazing. He's a brilliant piece in Small Gods where he talks about the root of religion, and it's a pity that it was shepherds and not goat herds, because goat are intelligent and have to be led. It's a really lovely piece. But he's just glorious. And as a writer, there are all these rules that you're supposed to kind of don't jump around in perspective and don't have really run-on sentences and things like that. And he just does them. And he just he'll hop around, skip and jump between five different perspectives in the course of a couple of pages. And you're never lost. He's this amazing voice.
Fantastic. Well, it's great to hear you talking about that, Dave. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you.
A reminder that Knights of the Borrowed Dark, Dave's first book, is out from Puffin from March the 10th. We will have, keep an eye out on our Twitter feed at Bookish Podcast, because we will have some signed copies to give away around about then. So great to have you, Dave, and
thanks so much
for coming in. Welcome back. This is the part of the show where we indulge ourselves and pick a book that we really loved and that more people should read. We call it Rediscover Classic or Second Look or...
Oh yeah, I always call it the wrong thing. I forgot what we're calling it
No, we each have our own distinct title for this part of the show.
I can't even remember which one's mine.
It adds up to the same thing. We pick a book that we think was overlooked first time, so that we can talk about it and get more people to read it. It's your choice this month, Bob. What do we go for?
We are going vintage crime. I'm on a crime roll this
you
month.
Are.
You may have noticed it's all about crime this month. It must be where my head's at. So I've picked out some vintage crime. So I've picked out Love Lies Bleeding by Edmund Crispin, a Gervais Fenn mystery. This was one of the books. Do you know libraries sometimes they have a trolley? I don't know if your library has this. Our local library has a trolley at the front of sort of books they're just giving away because nobody's taken them out for ages, or they've got too dog-eared, or something's wrong with them. And this is Malahide Library is my local library. I love my local library. I own a bookshop. I'm in my library all the time because I couldn't buy every book I want to read. So I live in the library as well. And of course, I walk in and, you know, you can't help but cast your eye at the rejected world of books that are no longer wanted. And this was sitting on the trolley and I was like, I love a bit of old crime. You know, I love sort of just those real, even Agatha Christie's, but even further back, those kind of 1920s, 1930s kind of crime novels before we all got so cynical and harsh. And so this was it. So Edmund Crispin, Love Lies Bleeding. I don't think I'd ever read... I had read one Edmund Crispin novel before, but I didn't know anything about this one. Picked it up. Originally written, I think, kind of in the late 40s, around about 1948, something like that. Gervais Fenn, there was obviously a whole series of Gervais Fenn mysteries. This one is set in a boys' boarding school. Gervais Fenn is sent down to present the prizes on awards giving day. It's all very boarding school, very old English, kind of very, you know, all that kind of thing. Bit like J.K. Rowling, you know, Harry Potter, but with a lot more murder and less magic, basically. And there's a lot of murders going on in this bit. And there's, you know, there's girls from the school next door getting murdered and attacked. And, you know, it's one of those things we always think it was also pleasant in, you know, the 1920s and 30s. And nowadays we're all much more violent and whatever. Some of the deaths that go on in this book, I tell you, you wouldn't know. It's bizarre the moral standings that we have. It's just, you can't just kill a schoolgirl for a bit of plot, you know, but yeah, go for it that.
As anyone who's watched Midsummer Murders would testify, the English villages are the most dangerous places you could live in.
I can't pretend I've ever watched Midsummer Murders, but thanks for sharing that, Shane. There we are. It's always good.
Did the butler do it?
The butler didn't do it, but no, I won't tell you. But there is a fantastic car chase at the end. It has to be said, there's this amazing car chase where they're trying to chase down the chase
car
down
chase
the
in
villain.
1940s.
I know, and it is, and there's a bit where there's a man, you know, he stands in the middle of the road and he's desperately trying to flag down the car that races past him, and he has to jump out the way, and then another car is chasing and he jumps back in the road, and it's all got that real kind of really old feel about it. There is also in this one, in Love Lies Bleeding, without giving too much away, there's a lost Shakespearean manuscript at the heart of the matter. The original manuscript to one of the Shakespeare plays that was thought to have been lost and never found. So it's also got a bit of a literary edge. It does go into a bit of classic kind of involvement around Shakespeare and his plays and that kind of thing. But you know what? I love it. And as I say, it's not as light and as, you know, happy kind of crime as you would think it would be. It's kind of quite brutal in places and quite dark in places. But, you know, one of those perfect for a cold, wet night in front of the fire kind of thing. So that was my rediscovered classic, Love Lies Bleeding by Edmund Crispin.
Fantastic. We're getting towards the end of the show now, so it's just time for Bob and I to point you in the direction of some new books that have been catching our eye for March, and there, it's fair to say there are a number now hitting the shelves, and lots of book launches happening over the next couple of weeks. The Stinging Fly, the latest edition of Stinging Fly, a big bumper edition in the wake of The Rising. It's a beautiful looking book.
It just hit the shelves last week, I think, a couple of days ago.
It's just out. It's launching at the Irish Writers' Centre in a couple of days' time. You can find that the information there on the Stinging Fly website. And it's guest edited by Sean O'Reilly, I think. But it's huge, and it invites. Reaction. It was a kind of a reaction to last year, where Robert Balla and a couple of others who kind of led an attempt to reclaim The Rising out of the hands of the infernal fucking politicians. so it's a kind of response to that, and it's a fantastic looking book. I haven't read any of it yet, but it's just out, and it looks great. So that's the Stinging Fly's latest edition, which is in the wake of The Rising.
Indeed, I've picked out, we'll stick with actually just a very quick one there, Slanting of the Sun, the Donal Ryan short stories, obviously very big tail end of last year for autumn. Just hitting the shelves 10th of March in a small paperback edition. One I haven't got to yet, it has to be said. I think I've read the lead story, Slanting of the Sun, but I haven't read any of the others. So I'll grab a paperback as soon as it hits the shelves, I think.
I've read a number of them, and they're really, really good. There's one of my favourite ones is Long Puck, which is about an Irish priest teaching the locals in Syria how to play hurling. And it's really excellently done. And everybody I read on Slanting of the Sun has a different favourite story, which is great. That's Donal Ryan's Slanting of the Sun out in paperback. Vertigo by Joanna Walsh, the latest book from Tramp Press, the small independent publisher here in Ireland. I think Vertigo was co-published in abroad. It's published by And Other Stories. And I love And Other Stories' work as well. It's a collection of short stories. I don't know much about it beyond that.
I have read it. Yeah. I got an early copy of that one via Tramp, and she's very talented, very disconcerting.
I've read a lot of Joanna's work. She's written a bit in Gorse. She's written a lot in Grant and several publications. She was also Joanna is also the person behind the Read Women movement, encouraging people to read more female authors. I'm led to believe this is a unique or
yeah, she has a very distinct style and very interesting, and say disconcerting is the word I would put forward for her stories. But certainly again a beautiful looking book coming from Tramp, and something different, and obviously they're not afraid to kind of push boundaries, and they've always said that they're committed to discovering new voices, and I think definitely Joanna Walsh is one of those new voices.
No Heroes from Little Island. We spoke about Little Island earlier on in connection with our book club for next month, which is Needlework by Deirdre Sullivan. This is also from Little Island. It's a book by Anna Seidel. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. Who cares if I am or not? Anna Seidel from she's German. She was only 16 when she wrote this book. It's a story of a school shooting and its aftermath. So very, very topical in terms of kind of what goes on regularly around the world. It was about 4 years ago since it was published in Germany. It's out. It's been translated by Siobhan Parkinson, the former, the great children's writer and former laureate, the Nogue, and the matriarch. Would you call her matriarch of Little Island Press? I think Anna is due to come over to Ireland in May, and she's only 20 now. Amazing. The story behind that is amazing. Looking forward to that one. It's out in around the middle of the month, like around St. Patrick's Day. That's No Heroes from Little Island Press.
I've picked a couple of non-Irish ones just to show we can be outside of Ireland as well. Some Rain Must Fall, My Struggle, Book 5 by Carl Ove Knausgaard, or Knausgaard, as I like to call it. I don't know if it's a silent K or not. it's his fictional autobiography, which intrigues me. Hard going. I must admit, I think I read the first one and started the second, but they're fairly full on. But, hugely well regarded and continued to sell. And I know, people are waiting for the next installment of that one. So that's out. just pretty much hitting the shelves now, actually, the start of March. And the other one, I've picked all the difficult names today, Hideo Yokoyama 6-4, which is a Japanese crime novel. See, I told you it was all crime today. Japanese crime novel. So 5 days in January 1989, the parents of a 7-year-old Tokyo schoolgirl sit and listen to the demands of a kidnapper. They would never learn his identity and they would never see their daughter again. But then in late 2002, it kind of develops and things start to resurface and it kind of moves on there. I'm hearing amazing things about it. I don't know how well it will do, but I'm hearing it's kind of one of those crime novels you really should read this year. So I'm going to give it a shot. That's 6-4 by Hideo Yokoyama. And again, I think it's just hitting the shelves about now.
So we've butchered names from Germany, Norway and Japan already. My final pick is, I can pronounce this one, Timothy Egan. And that's the only reason I picked it. The Immortal Irishman. Timothy Egan is a New York Times writer, has certainly been a New York Times correspondent in the past. He's won Pulitzer and various things. This is his latest book, The Immortal Irishman, the Irish Revolutionary Who Became an American Hero. It's about Thomas Francis Marr, who left Ireland, one of the exodus around the time of the famine, ended up in Tasmania, managed to escape from Tasmania and get to America. He formed the Irish Brigade, or he led the Irish Brigade in New York and in many of the battles of the Civil War, Bull Run, Antietam, Fredericksburg. He was twice shot from his horse while leading charges. He was left for dead in the Virginia mud. His dream was that Irish American troops, the Irish Americans would, having learned everything about the art of war, would return to the old sod and lead the uprising against the British. So he's somebody I never heard of. I don't know anything about him, and that's brand new out. I think it may be, I'm not sure if it's out in this part of the world now. It can certainly be got an e-book, but you wouldn't do that, would you?
No.
You can get it. It's out in hardback just around about now. But you may have to seek it out. But that's The Immortal Irishman, the Irish Revolutionary Who Became an American Hero by Timothy Egan.
Lovely. And one final one for me, a very quick mention for Cecilia Ahern. No, Cecilia Ahern. Flawed, her very first young adult novel. Haven't had a chance to read it. I think she did some preview stuff last week. My understanding is due out 24th of March, but I've got a feeling there might be a slightly earlier release within Ireland, as there often is. Cecilia Ahern trying something very different, young adult, kind of dystopian type novel, as far as I understand it. So it would just be interesting, and I think it's one of those authors that maybe gets judged too quickly.
Without being read, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, without being read, and so this will be really interesting to see how this works for her. And best of luck. She's lovely. What can you say?
Yeah, that's our new books pick for March. To finish up with a few the events happening around the country, I suppose the big one for March is the Mountains of the Sea Festival. I think are you on that committee too?
Yeah, I'm not on that committee, but we do the books for Mountains of the Sea. We do the adult books and the children's books for Mountains of the Sea Festival, not the poetry side of it. Mountains of the Sea Festival, it's the first festival of the season, about to kick off again. Here we go again. Literary festivals are go, always good. So Mountains of the Sea runs from the 9th to the 13th of March. A huge roundup of great authors again across fiction, kids, and it also includes what used to be the Poetry Now Festival, so quite a lot of poetry events as well. Neil Jordan's there, Paul Muldoon's there.
Yeah, Paul Muldoon, see, he's a rock star poet, he really is. The picture of him on the website is like, yeah, you'd think that in another time he's a rock star. Yeah.
Indeed, well, in a bizarre way, we do the books down for Electric Picnic at the Literary Tent as well, and he's been down at the Electric Picnic Literary Tent for the last couple of years, and he has that rock star
he
in a
does,
field
he has
down
that aura,
to a
yeah.
He's
sure does. And he's doing a masterclass for teenage poets as well, which I'm not sure if tickets are still available for that, but if they are and you have somebody who's a writer in the house, get along for that, because that is a once in a lifetime experience to get in a room with Paul Muldoon, kind of a masterclass. Loads happening, and lots of stuff outside of books as well. Just a few of the other authors who are there, Lisa McInerney, Mike McCormick, Thomas Morris, the writer, and he's the editor of Sting and Fly as well. Nell Zink.
Nell Zink will be a really interesting one.
Yeah, she's talking to Sinead Gleeson. Really, really interesting. Then non-fiction, you've Paul Mason and David Aronovich. Given that we've... we voted left. Did we vote left or we vote protest? I'm not sure. The two lefties anyway talking about, maybe telling us what the left is, because I don't think we know.
I'm not sure anybody knows what they voted for in the end.
Yeah, we know.
Such as that.
Benji Davis is there as well, and he's the children's book writer. He had one of my favourite children's books of last year, which was Granddad's Island. If you read, it's a picture book of about 20 odd pages, 30 pages. If you read Granddad's Island and don't cry, there's something wrong. So it's amazing, and I think it's sold out, unfortunately. So that's just a testament to the success of everything in Mountains to Sea. But yeah, there's so much going on. There's lots going on outside of books as well. It's a book festival, but it's an arts festival, and there's a huge amount going on over the course of 5 days out there.
Indeed, so all the information on that, mountainstosea.ie, includes bookings.
Certainly. We've a couple of other book launches. We mentioned Vertigo and The Stinging Fly both launching over the next few days. We had Dave Rudden on the show earlier on. His book, Knights of the Borrowed Dark, is also launching. I think it's the 10th of March. We had another launch, Even the Daybreak, which is 35 years of Salmon Press poetry, is launching this weekend. If you're one of the early downloaders in County Clare at the Doolin Writers Weekend, it's in Hotel Doolin. So there's lots of stuff happening around the country in terms of book launches. And one final thing from me in terms of events, I'm not sure if you have anything to add, Bob, but the book clinic from Children's Books Ireland, they have a nationwide tour of book clinics. For young readers looking for a new series or anything, any questions or anything at all, mm-hmm. it is what it says. It is a book clinic, and it's appearing all around the country. Tipperary, Sligo, Tralee, Letterkenny, Belfast, the St. Patrick's Big Day Out Festival in Merrion Square on March the 20th. It's at the Stole Writers Week a bit later in the year as well. So yeah, anywhere if you're around the country, I think book clinic from the Children's Books Ireland should be not far away from you at some point over the next few months.
Yes, and finally one for me, actually one that came in via Twitter on my way in today that I thought I'd give quite quick mention. The Society of Young Publishers is a society that's been going on in the UK for quite a number of years and been quite successful about bringing sort of young publishing people together. They don't have to be a publisher, but they work within publishing. So they've just set up an Irish branch, and they just sent me a little tweet just to say that they're having a kind of a launch kind of introduction on the 30th of March in the Liquor Room in the middle of Dublin there. I don't know an awful lot more about it, so if you're interested, if you're involved in publishing in Ireland and want to learn a bit more, maybe just follow them on Twitter. It's at SYPEIRE, E-I-R-E, and you know, and see about getting involved and see about coming along to their kind of launch. It's kind of always good, I think, to bring people in the industry together and to talk to each other, so it could be an interesting one for people who are listening.
Nepotism is nepotism. I don't know. Nepotism is different. But to mention Blackbird Books before we wrap up, we have we have an Easter Rising event happening on, I think it's the 30th, Wednesday, and the Wednesday of Easter week. I think it's the 30th of March. Frank Scholdice, who's written Grandpa the Sniper. It's a family history book. His grandfather took part in the Rising and the War of Independence. And he died in the 70s, and he had never spoken about it during his lifetime. So Frank, his grandson, has researched that and put together a fantastic looking book from Liffey Press. So he's coming to the shop on the 30th to talk about the process behind that and the story. And it's something I'm really looking forward to. It is a little bit different as Easter Rising books go. There's so many 1916 books out now, but this is one that caught my eye for. It was a little bit different.
Great. So as Shane barricades himself into Blackbird Books, that's this episode of Bookish Done. Thank you very much for listening. Thanks for joining us. And again, just a reminder, if you want to subscribe or listen online, it's castaway.media/bookish, or follow us at Bookish Podcast on Twitter. And on the website there, you can obviously subscribe to get all the Bookish downloads and also just stay in contact with what's going on. Thank you very much for enjoying us and have a good month.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
This was a Castaway Media production. Find more great podcasts on our network. Visit castaway.media.